Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I'm your host for today, Maggie Westbold, together with my co-host, Susan Franson.
Hello, Maggie. Today is Veterans Day holiday, and KHOI honors veterans of all wars. It is also time to congratulate the winners in all the city elections in our listening area. We'll probably hear more on both subjects in our weekly news roundup from Dennis Hart coming up. Later in the show, we'll also hear from Dennis Malpitsky, Mary Rankin will round out our show.
This is also the end of the first week of our fall membership drive. Our goal is 25 new members. If you haven't joined already, we hope you will be part of keeping KHOI growing and thriving. As we begin our fifth year, we continue to add new volunteers. I'm one, and I'm surprised at how much I've already learned.
We are certainly happy to have you. You are adding so many new ideas for topics for the Local Talk team to cover. Because you are a poet, your interview with Dennis Malpitsky today will be especially insightful. We invite you listeners to honor his poetry by joining us as members and to recognize that there are all kinds of ways new volunteers can have rewarding things to do around here. A basic membership is $55, though if you can afford $100, it would help us even more. And for members at either of these basic membership levels, please consider becoming sustaining members at $20 per month or $250 per year. Just give us a call at 515-292-2878 or go online at khoifm.org and press the donate button. Or stop by at the Pantorium, 410 Douglas, to drop off a check and let us thank you in person.
And now it's time for News with Dennis Hart.
This was another really big week of news in and around Ames, much of it centered on elections. So here we go. In Tuesday's Ames Tribune, word that the number of absentee and early voting ballots the Story County Auditor's Office had received for Tuesday's election was on pace with the number of ballots received in 2015. Auditor Lucy Martin said her office had received 736 ballots, and she predicted the number would go up, likely falling somewhere close to the 760 that were received 2 years ago. Most of those ballots had come from Ames voters, who had turned in 576 early ballots out of the 684 they had requested. Nevada voters had requested 119 absentee ballots and had turned in 112 of them. Also in Tuesday's Trib, a story about incoming Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein, who told the newspaper she wants to improve communication and foster diversity and inclusiveness on campus. Winterstein will assume her new role as university president on November 20th. It's the latest step in her 38-year career at the university. She arrived on campus in 1979 and served as an extension associate in entomology, among other roles. She earned a Ph.D. in entomology at ISU and has been the endowed dean of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences since 2006. She was chosen to succeed former ISU president Stephen Leith, who left last spring to become president of Auburn University. Winterstein will become the university's 16th and first female president. She told the Tribune that while it's sad for her to leave the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, in her words, "I'm excited to work with all the units on campus." She said she still has a lot to learn and she thinks her appointment is a great fit for Iowa State. She said she plans to foster strong inter-university communication, engagement, and representation. She said her top priorities will be working together with faculty, staff, students, and Ames residents to determine ways to make the university more efficient, to enhance the university's overall student experience, and to find ways to conduct research programs to lead to an entrepreneurial culture within the school's programs. Winterstein said she would work with city representatives to maintain conversations and build on the partnerships between ISU and Ames, and work on existing practices to help improve graduation rates for students who need more assistance. She said in her words, "We have to hear what our faculty, staff, and students want to say to us, what their story is. That's how you build a team that will take us forward to the next level." She also said she thinks the university is at a good size and that it's providing what is needed for its students. Also in Tuesday's Tribune, two community members called for the Ames School District to handle controversial situations and bullying better. Their comments came during the public school board meeting Monday night. One member of the public said that the district needs to hire a director of equity. She said there needs to be an effort to ensure that all students are treated fairly and with equity both inside and outside the classroom, and that an experienced director of equity would be able to tackle that effort. Another resident expressed frustration over bullying within the district. The resident said she's volunteered with international minority families in the community over the past couple of years, and that a consistent issue among them has been severe bullying. She said there have been instances where students have been repeatedly bullied because of, among other things, their skin color, learning disabilities, or dyslexia. School board member Lewis Rosser talked about the recent incident in which racial slurs were found inside an Ames High locker room. Rosser said that highlighted the need for Ames students to continue to be educated on how to deal with diversity in an appropriate manner. In Wednesday's Tribune, of course, the big story was John Hala's victory in his race to become the next mayor of Ames. Hala defeated former city council member and co-founder of the Ames Progressive Alliance, Victoria Sapinski, on Tuesday. He won 58% of the vote to Sapinski's 41.5%. His margin of victory was more than 1,300 votes. Hala told the Tribune that he is honored and humbled by his victory. He held his election night party with friends and family at the Arcadia Cafe in Campustown. That's close to where Hala Architecture, Structure, and Planning used to be located. The mayor-elect founded that firm more than 3 decades ago and sold it to senior employees last year. Hala has served as president of the Campustown Action Association and is the current president of Ames Transit Board. During his campaign, Hala talked about collaboration and how he would facilitate dialogue between groups that might have competing interests. He also said he wants to keep Ames' current trajectory pointed upward. He supports initiatives such as the Lincoln Way Corridor and Healthy Life Center projects. Hala said he sees the mayor's role, in his words, as creating a warm, engaged, positive environment in which people know they're going to be heard and respected. It may not always go exactly the way they want, he said, but again in his words, I'm going to be asking people to trust me, that I have the community's best interest in mind, not one particular group or the loudest voice in the room. Hala had received the endorsement of outgoing Mayor Ann Campbell, but Sapinski had raised more campaign money with almost 3 times the number of individual voters. She told the Tribune that, in her words, we had an amazing campaign that was professionally run and never did any negative campaigning, and we are so proud of ourselves. In other Ames races on Tuesday, David Martin won the Ward 3 City Council seat, defeating Rob Bowers by 67 votes. Martin, an Ames native and owner of a software forensics company, received 52% of the vote. Bowers, a former deputy chief of the Iowa State Police Department, received 48%. Martin had campaigned on improving the city's internet infrastructure as his top priority. He said Ames is not in need of any major revamping and that he just wants to help improve his hometown in any way possible. Councilmember Gloria Betcher in Ward 1 and at-large Councilmember Amber Corrieri ran unopposed and easily kept their seats. About 18% of registered voters in Ames cast ballots in the mayoral race, the highest turnout rate in a city election since 2003. In voting for the Mary Greeley Medical Center Board of Trustees, current trustee Mary Kitchell was reelected, along with newcomer Beth Swenson. Mary Greeley is a city-owned hospital, and its 5-member board works as a governing body to set broad policies for the hospital and serve in an oversight role. Also in Wednesday's Trib, word that a medallion displayed on Iowa State's central campus has been reported missing since August, and law enforcement and university employees are looking for help from the public to find it. That medallion celebrates landscape design. Back in 1999, ISU was chosen as one of about 300 locations to be a medallion site by the American Society of Landscape Architects. Those sites recognize landscapes that are special to the heart and soul due to landscape architecture. Since then, the award has been displayed on a flat rock on the west side of Curtis Hall on campus. But in August, a campus employee noticed it was missing. The disappearance was reported to the campus police department. ISU Police Department Deputy Chief Kerry Jacobs said no tips about the location of the medallion have been received. It's not known when the medallion actually went missing. Jacobs said while it might well have been stolen, it also could have been knocked off by a snowplow over the winter and been lost or even accidentally thrown away. A landscape architect for ISU Facilities Planning and Management, Rhonda Martin, said if the medallion was stolen, it was likely not meant to be malicious and that the award could have been picked up by someone who wanted to keep a physical piece of the campus. If the medallion cannot be recovered, a replacement likely will have to be obtained. Anyone with information about the medallion is encouraged to call the ISU Police Department. Also in Wednesday's Tribune, the interim dean of Iowa State's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences has been appointed. Joe Coletti, who is now Senior Associate Dean of that college and the Associate Director of the Iowa Agriculture and Home Economics Experiment Station, will take over as Interim Dean November 20th. He's taking over for former Dean Wendy Winterstein, who's been chosen, of course, as Iowa State's next president. In a news release, Winterstein said that Coletti is familiar with every aspect of the college's mission and operations and its service to the people of Iowa. A national search for Winterstein's permanent replacement will be launched in the coming weeks. And there's more in Wednesday's Tribune. The Story County Board of Supervisors has named Tiffany Meredith as lead criminal prosecutor for the county attorney's office and Timothy Meals as first assistant. Both are already with the attorney's office and received promotions. The board also moved to reschedule adopting a contract to upgrade two road sheds in the county after staff noticed that the motion approving the contract violated the open meetings law. Supervisor Loris Olson had moved to approve the bid to repair the sheds in a previous meeting when the discussion on the agenda was only to look at bids. The board voted to approve the lowest bid, but the action was null and void because it was not awarded through proper procedures. Olson apologized to the board and offered to pay the fine for violating open meetings rules, but the county attorney said paying a fine was not necessary. And yes, there's more in Wednesday's trip. The Story County Community Foundation awarded 18 different grants totaling more than $110,000 during a ceremony at Ryman Gardens. 12 grants totaling more than $74,000 were awarded to projects with countywide impact, and about $36,000 was awarded to six projects impacting individual communities in Story County. For example, the all-inclusive playground and miracle field project to be built at Inez Grove Park in Ames received a grant of $25,000. In Thursday's Tribune, word that some businesses on South Duff were affected by a water main break on the street. The break was first reported Wednesday afternoon. It involved a water main that was 55 years old. Businesses on the east side of Duff between 3rd and South 5th were affected. Also in Thursday's paper, hundreds of Ames High School students, staff, and members of the district administration crowded into the school gymnasium on Wednesday to see one of their own honored by Governor Kim Reynolds as the 2018 Iowa Teacher of the Year. She is Eileen Sullivan, who has taught chemistry at Ames High since 1996. She told the crowd that Ames High is the best school in Iowa and that, in her words, "I couldn't be more proud to represent all of you as an ambassador of education." Sullivan was chosen from 80 applicants for this year's award. She was chosen by a committee that included representatives from various education organizations. Sullivan said she strives to create a classroom environment where students are actively involved by asking them a lot of questions and by creating multiple opportunities for students to think about their answers. She said putting students in charge of their own learning leads to deeper thinking skills and keeps them engaged. Also in Thursday's Trib, a story about Iowa State students and faculty working together to build a mobile model of the university's iconic campanile. The original campanile has towered over Central Campus since 1897, and bells inside have been ringing out across campus for decades. The mobile model will have 27 bells of its own, and visitors will be able to get an up-close look at both the smaller campanile and the bells. The mobile version will stand about 20 feet tall and weigh between 2,400 and 3,000 pounds. The idea for the project began a couple of years ago, and since then, individuals from the Colleges of Design and Engineering and others have come together to tackle the project. The design process is nearly complete, and the mobile campanile could be under construction by next spring. When it's finished, the mobile campanile will be able to travel to university events, graduation ceremonies, sporting events, the Iowa State Fair, and other locations. The entire cost of the project is estimated at $210,000. Currently, the project has received $145,000 through sponsors and fundraising. Also in Thursday's Trib, word that a public input session for the third phase of the South Grand Avenue extension will take place next Tuesday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. at Ames City Hall. The third phase is already underway and includes the extension of South 5th from South Grand to South Duff. During the input session, the preferred alignment for the street will be discussed, as will information about a shared use path starting at South Grand and continuing through the Iowa State Research Park. Also Thursday, a story that the city of Ames has been recognized for having the state's best-tasting water during a blind-tasting event held in Council Bluffs. It was the first competition for the city of Ames since its new water treatment plant went into operation. And the official kickoff of Snow Magic in Ames takes place this evening in downtown Ames. It features a tree lighting, a festival of trees at the Octagon Center, and much more. In this week's Nevada Journal, election results. Brett Barker won the race to become Nevada's next mayor. Luke Spence won the race for the Ward 2 Nevada City Council seat, and Dane Nielsen won the Ward 4 seat. Also in the Journal, word that DuPont Industrial Biosciences announced last week that it's planning to sell its Nevada ethanol plant 2 years after it finished building the multimillion-dollar facility. All refinery operations have been closed, and a small group of employees will maintain the plant while a buyer is found. About 90 people were employed full-time there, along with 150 temporary employees. The $225 million plant was intended to be the largest producer of ethanol created from material left over from harvesting corn and soybeans. It was unveiled 2 years ago, but never produced ethanol. In this week's Boone News Republican election results, Boone incumbent Mayor John Slight was reelected. Winners in various city council races were David Byrd in Ward 1, Elijah Steins in Ward 3, Greg Picklap in Ward 5, and Holly Stecker won an at-large seat. Also in the News Republican, the much-anticipated Alice Project Senior Apartment Living Complex broke ground last week on Hawkeye Drive in Boone. The complex will have 50 units, which will be a mix of one and two bedrooms. It is scheduled to be completed by late fall or early winter next year. Also in the paper, word that the First United Methodist Church in Boone will give a free Thanksgiving Day meal to anyone who would like one. The meal will be served from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Everything will be prepared by volunteers. This is the 20th year the church will serve a free meal on Thanksgiving. In this week's Story City Herald results from Tuesday's election, Mike Jensen was reelected Story City Mayor with 94% of the votes. In Roland, Andrew Webb was elected mayor with 93%. Also in Roland, a ballot measure regarding library trustees passed overwhelmingly. That measure calls for the Board of Trustees of the library to consist of four resident members and one non-resident. Also in the Herald, word that the Roland Story School District will hold two informational meetings to lay out plans for a new athletic stadium and a renovated high school auditorium. Those meetings will take place next Tuesday at the high school library in Story City and next Thursday at the middle school library in Roland. Both meetings start at 7 p.m. The district has hired Hala Architecture and Ames to develop plans for a new athletic facility at the current Outlet Mall location. The plans include a new field, a new track, a parking lot, concessions, bathrooms, and locker rooms. The district wants to relocate the stadium because of safety, flooding, and environmental issues. A $5.3 million bond issue for all of this will take place on February 6th. And that's the summary of a very busy week of news in and around Ames.
Thank you, Dennis. Dennis is also one of our newest volunteers for Lowest Local Talk, and he goes out to California for the winter and follows the Ames News to give us our weekly reports. This is dedication, but he does it because he loves it. Think about that as you think about volunteering. It's so much fun, you want to do it on vacation. KHOI would also like to thank the following sponsors of the KHOI 2017 Fall Membership Drive: Morning Bell Coffee Roasters, the Ames Chamber of Commerce, Greater Iowa Credit Union, Mary Greeley Medical Center, Alluvial Brewing Company, and the Mucky Duck Pub.
This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. One particularly noteworthy event is the Aaron O'Neill's YouTube from our road trip to the special exhibit at the Slater Area Historical Association's night at the museum. Aaron really catches the feeling, as well as great pictures from the special exhibit honoring the Slater boys who volunteered in World War I, or the Great War. See it on our Facebook page. This is the kind of creativity and community support made possible by your donations to KHOI. It's easy to join as a member for KHOI. You can go to our website, khoifm.org, and press the donate button, or you can use your smartphone to text 515-200-7758, or you can call us at 515-292-2878, and a friendly volunteer will take you through the steps.
We have Dennis Malsby and Maggie talking to him.
Hello, KHOI listeners. I am Maggie Westfold, and I'm here today with Dennis Malsby. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you, ma'am.
We're speaking with Dennis because he's a local author and poet who's just been awarded the Silver Medal Award for 2017 by the Military Writers Society of America for his book Free Fire Zone. This is in their annual contest in the science fiction category. And this is a second national recognition received by Free Fire Zone in 2017. It was named a finalist by the International Book Awards. I'm going to read a review here by the Military Writers Society of America, which really really speaks to this work of Dennis's. Sometimes we are compelled to fight evil. To do so, we must become evil at times. This novel is about the risk of becoming that which you confront. Free Fire Zone by Dennis Malsby is a complex novel. It is a combination thriller, literary fiction, and science fiction. The novel speaks to the pain of war and the horror observed therein and the inner battle the warrior fights to resist becoming what he has to be on the battlefield. Malsby addresses the demons created by PTSD, but he brings his demon to life, imbuing it with personality and power beyond any description I've read before. One does what one must in war in order to survive and support his warrior brothers. There is heart-rending, heart-changing danger in doing that. Malsby tackles the topic head-on, breathes life into it, even if it makes a reader uncomfortable. This is mature audience reading for sure. And that review was by Mike Mullins, the Military Writers Society of America. Before we talk further, Dennis, would you like to give people your contact information?
Sure.
Website, Facebook page, anything like that?
Yes, I have a website. It has information, further information about my background, and also has a list of publications. There's even some music. During the 60th anniversary of the Omaha beach landings, National Public Radio picked up a poem of mine about that event and said it had Marlene Dietrich singing Lilia Marlene in German in the background.
Ah.
So that's out there with a link that you can go to. And also, more recently, one of the classical composers in Des Moines took about five or six of my haiku and set them to neo-classical music, a piano and a soprano. So if you have that, if you're a classical music fan, you might want to take a listen to that as well. Plus, I've listed the books that I'm working on. There's books that I published and books that I'm working on, so you can get kind of a little look at where I'm going. And that website is www.dennismalsby.com. And if you're confused about the name, and most people are, it's spelled M-A-U-L-S-B-Y. So it's www.dennismalsby.com.
Dennis, I'm going to let you read now from your book excerpts that you've chosen to share with us today. Would you like to read
sure.
some? Yes.
Let me start out with just with the very first short story. The book is can be looked at either as a novel or a book of linked short stories, and it was a way that I used to become more proficient in writing. So I've written basically 17 linked short stories. And each of them are linked by the hero, who you pick up in his 20s in Vietnam. There's three or four stories about him in Vietnam, and then the rest of the stories are about him back in the States. They end with him in his 70s on his farm in Iowa, looking back on his life. Of course, he brings Vietnam with him. You know, he comes back to the United States, as all veterans do. If they're in combat, they bring those memories back with them. Mm-hmm. So those haunt him, you know, throughout his life, as they do with most veterans. But this first short story takes place in Vietnam. The black came, blacker than black, not just the absence of light, a blackness of sound, a blackness of mind and soul. It crept in, as it always did, after the rocket attacks, in those morning hours that one wanted to believe were inviolate. It grew so thick, the pulse of its organs could be felt against the skin. The blackness filled every surface and irregularity. The slow tide would crest the earth berm, leak through the sandbag bunkers to touch booted feet, and then rise to groins and chests. It filled the barrels of rifles and pressed cloth against flesh, pushed out the air as it entered pores, noses, and ears, until its acid velvet was all there was. I prayed that while it had our bodies and minds, it would not take our souls. If by some chance God let us return, I knew it would still be inside us, marking us as lepers to wives and lovers, parents, friends, and worst of all, to each other. Pain in my knuckles brought me back a little. I pulled my fist back from the sandbagged wall. We'd go out soon. I listened to the breathing of the others. The acrid odor of confined male fear burned my nostrils. I assured myself we were safe. The sides of the bunker were built into 10-foot-high earth berms. The exposed front face consisted of four thicknesses of alternating sandbags pounded with mallets into rock-hard walls. Overhead, rough-cut wood beams topped with perforated steel runway panels supported layers of sandbags. Similar bunkers looked out every 50 meters, their weapons ports aligned for interlocking fire. Even so, the threat of ground attack was not the danger tonight. Charlie's artillery rockets had delay fuses. They dug in deep, cratering the runways at the airstrip. They would also burst through bunker roofs before exploding. I didn't want to be one of those. My blood leaking into the grasping dirt, suffocating while I listened to the muffled shouts of men above trying to dig me out. The attacks came three or four times a week, always in the early hours. The enemy didn't want you rested. After months of sleep deprivation and adrenaline highs, soldiers became emotionally bruised and unfocused, susceptible to delusions and neurotic behavior. I should know. And this is a romance.
Oh, boy.
We have a couple of stories where romance is the feature. And he has just met, Tegeler is back in the United States. He's got himself a truck with a pop-up camper on it, and he's vacationing. And he stopped in Brewster County, Texas, at a little museum outside of town. And he's met this lovely redhead.
Okay.
They have a conversation, and she lets him plug his camper in back of the museum, and they have dinner together. The pair feasted on Gala apple slices and red seedless grapes while Rod set up a two-burner Coleman stove on the outside table to fry scrambled eggs with green chilies and tomato salsa. Cold Scheinerbach beer accompanied the meal. He pulled a blue enameled percolator off the second burner. Kona coffee, madam, to cap off the evening? No, wait up. I need one more item. Tegeler vanished into the camper and soon returned with a hooded sweatshirt and a mysterious bottle. Put this on, my dear biologist. The desert feels a bit cool after dark. And something more to warm us, he said, waving a long-necked, dark bottle. Holding out her coffee cup, Pepper said, Napoleon brandy. You sure know how to treat a girl. The two continued coffee and conversation for another half hour, snuggled together to fox the cold air. During the stories of their lives chatter, Pepper seemed happy to learn he, too, came from a rural background. She knew more about cattle, and he more about hogs. Both paraded childhood memories. Tegeler mentioned his military service and the time spent in Vietnam, but refused to respond with details to her probing questions. After several more cognacs, they started telling funny stories about various relatives. The laughter grew in volume, scaring off all the prowling night creatures within 50 yards. The voices finally gasped into silence. Tegeler felt huge hands squeezing his heart. His temperature flared. The reptile opened jaws, tongue flicked out, tasting. The tip of his tail quivered. The woman's muscles tensed as she felt her own heart song merge into his, the sexual tension as thick, rich, and sweet as chocolate brownies. Pepper took his shaking hands and led him into the camper.
Very nice. I'm going to have to get back to your book.
Well, there's something there for everybody.
I'd like to talk to you now about how you came to your writing career. You're a retired bank president from Ames and a writer of poetry, prose, and fiction. We just heard you read from a very successful book, Dennis, you grew up in Marshalltown, and you're a 1964 graduate of Grinnell College. You're a U.S. Army Vietnam veteran, and you served with the 25th Infantry Division there. Your poems and short stories have been published in numerous online and print journals, and your work has received a Pushcart nomination. Your first book of poems, Remembering Willie, won silver medal awards from two military writers' organizations. And your third book of poems, Near Death, Near Life, published by Prolific Press, won a Military Writers Society of America gold medal in 2016 and was named a finalist in the Best Book Awards. And the cover art for that book was nominated for an award in the Da Vinci Cover Art Award Program. And you're a past president of IPA, the Iowa Poetry Association. How does a political science graduate, a military veteran, become a poet and novelist and win awards doing it?
Well, first of all, it's good to have a great educational background. And, of course, Iowa schools provided that. And in Iowa schools, we were constantly being asked to write. And, of course, when you got to college, writing became even more important. And I, kind of was fighting against that. You know, I really did not have a desire to be a great writer early in my life. I got into the military, and I thought, boy, they won't want me to write too much. But they did. You had to write reports. You had to write all kinds of things. They had to be clear and definitive. Then I got out of the service. One of my peacetime jobs involved writing, especially the first one with the Chamber of Commerce in Duluth, Minnesota, where I was their publications guy. So I had to do all their publications. I dealt with the news media and learned how to write news releases and do radio spots and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So wherever I went, I was fated to write, whether mm-hmm. I wanted to or not.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah. When I got back from Vietnam, of course, like we all did, the veterans have to find ways to deal with what they brought back with them. And I tried a lot of different things, and what I really found that was most successful was creativity. And I would offer that as a way for veterans to deal with any kind of traumatic experiences they've had, or even people that are not veterans that have had traumatic experiences. And whatever creativity turns you on. I still shied away from writing. I tried painting and sculpting and hooking rugs and designing furniture and all kinds of things before I finally turned to writing. None of the other things seemed to last long enough. But, in English, we have over 1 million words in our language. And I mm-hmm. found that it's unlikely I'm going to run out of those words, in my lifetime.
I agree. Okay.
So I started about maybe 20 years ago to actually write seriously. Started out with poetry. And my scheme or plan was to start out with poetry because of poetry's ability to, in short spaces and few words, to evoke emotion and sensuality and color and all kinds of senses. And my theory was if I'd gotten fairly reasonably good at writing poetry, that I would try to carry this, the passion of poetry over into prose in short stories. Mm-hmm. Short stories structurally resemble poems in that, they're not long. You have to use concentrated language in order to make your point. And then from short stories, I would want to go into novels. So I've gotten poems published, short stories published, and now I'm trying to get some novels published. So if anybody knows a publisher that would like to review a few of my novels in draft, I'd be happy to send them.
It was your poetry about your experiences in Vietnam that really brought home to me how important it is that we say thank you to everybody who served our country in the military, especially in wartime. So thank you again. I have a daughter and a son who never served, and they likely won't. And for that fact, I'll never have to experience the worry of having my child serve in wartime in a foreign country. And I've been blessed. Of course, I have grandchildren, many grandchildren, and we don't know their futures. But I say thank you to veterans when I meet them here and there, and it's because of your words. Is there anything more that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I've got a couple more selections from the book, if that's okay.
Sure, yes,
and,
please.
One of the themes that runs through the book, besides the fact that the hero, Lieutenant Tegeler, is in each of the books, is that he comes back from Vietnam with what they call a multiple personality disorder. He's actually got a second personality that's developed. And the second personality is a berserker personality. Mm. This is rare but not uncommon when you get soldiers in combat. The berserkers, of course, rarely survive. They're either killed by the enemy because they go without any fear, or sometimes they're shot by their own troops because when they go berserk, everybody's
yeah.
the enemy.
Right.
Their friends and as well as the opposing sides. But he has this kind of reptilian berserker personality that comes out when he's in serious danger. And the more it comes out, the stronger it gets and the more it wants to take over. And about halfway through the book, the two personalities are equally strong and they either have to be harmonized or one must supplant the other. And I won't tell you how that's done. People have to get the book to find out.
Mm-hmm.
But here's a little bit about the berserker personality. It all started in Vietnam. Killed too many, stayed too long, betrayed by his commanders, kept getting tossed into life or death events. The more killing, the more the barriers broke. The reptile personality in the brain clawed out, became stronger, increasingly berserk each time. Rod was willing to die, wanted to die. It didn't. Whatever acts the situation required to survive, the creature did, more than a normal man could stomach. Calling it up, would he be able to kill it, or?
That was Dennis Mousby, leaving us at a particularly suspenseful point in his new book, Free Fire Zone, which he's been discussing with Maggie Westfold. Thank you for coming in, Dennis. This is KHOI Community Radio, one of your renewable resources of this community. Why renewable? Because it returns to the air every day with new stories, new ideas, and news about the people you know or people of interest. But we can only continue to renew ourselves with your help. Help us to pay the rent and keep the broadcast signal on with the lights. How can you do that? By becoming a member, or if you are a member, by renewing right now. Then you become a renewable resource for us. And what do you do? You just call 515-292-2878 or text us at 515-200-7758 or pledge securely online at our website, khoifm.org. Help renew this renewable resource.
Even our programming has tips for renewable living. Our monthly guest, Mary Rankin, is here to tell us about sustainability. Mary Rankin, Sustainability Director for ISU and City of Ames, stopped by for her monthly visit to update you on sustainability and environmental issues as part of civic life. She came by KHOI yesterday and spoke with Ursula Rudenberg together with two guests. Mary brought with her Autumn Rudlong, an ISU student and founder of the Food Recovery Network student organization at Iowa State, and the organizer's faculty advisor, Laura Merrick. Dr. Merrick is a faculty member in agronomy. Here's Mary introducing her guests.
We are entering that time of the year where we're going to be doing a lot of holiday celebrations, producing a lot of food. And, of course, one of the challenges with producing and cooking food is that we have waste related to food. And so I am so excited to be able to bring Autumn Rudlong and also Laura Merrick to the show with me today. And Autumn has been a part of founding a student organization on campus related to food waste recovery. Autumn, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Food Waste Recovery Network?
Sure. The Food Recovery Network is a countrywide organization that works on college campuses to help prevent food waste produced by college students and college dining centers. This, I think, resonates with a lot of students in that we kind of have to find the way to lower our impact on the environment. And
a cool thing about this network is connecting to community. So it's a way that college students can do something on their campus, but also be simultaneously serving a need in the broader community in which their campus is situated. I'm Laura Merrick, faculty member in the agronomy department at Iowa State University.
And the advisor for the Food Recovery Network.
Yes, I'm the club advisor. Mm-hmm. Official clubs at Iowa State University have faculty members who serve as advisors. Autumn and other students had actually formed this activity. They had become a chapter of the national organization a full 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But last winter, Autumn and the other club officers approached me about helping them become an official Iowa State club. You can get financial resources and recognition in doing so. But it turned out Autumn had approached me with perfect timing because for over 3 years now, I've been teaching sections of an undergraduate course known as World Food Issues. Mm. And I had decided that I would have a graded activity implemented in my course with community service connected to food and agriculture. So as we started brainstorming and talking together about logistics, I realized the club members could recruit the up to 50 students per semester in literally hundreds and hundreds of students take World Food Issues every semester because it counts for ethics credit and it counts for international perspectives distribution credit, et cetera. So students who aren't necessarily majoring in food science or dietetics or nutrition or agriculture topics would be potentially interested in this course.
Autumn, what are you studying?
I'm studying food science.
Is your interest mostly social or environmental?
I would say it's a little bit of both, but more leaning towards the social aspect of it, with the fact that we do produce so much food and we're consumers and we request all this food. And I think it's definitely something that is ingrained in me to kind of fix something that I may have messed up.
When you say you messed up, what do you mean?
I know when I go to a dining center, I want as many options possible. So kind of fixing a problem that would have happened because of my choices or my needs. So I'm working to reduce the amount of food that would go in the trash through my own and through the club.
It's exciting to see that our students want to try different types of food. But that then, from a standpoint of providing it, makes it much more complicated and much more open to having waste, right? So if everybody ate the same dish every day, we would be able to coordinate the amount that's made. But with all the choices comes the opportunity mm-hmm. for more waste.
Nancy Lewandowski, a former director of ISU Dining, had commented once that as a director of a college dining center, a really important aspect for food provisioning is making sure that students who come early to, say, the lunch meal have the same experience that students coming late or vice versa.
Mm, sure.
And so necessarily that's another driver for mm-hmm. producing
right.
potentially way more food than is actually needed for a given meal.
Of course. So Autumn, you recognize the opportunity, recognize the challenges. Tell us about how you went about making this food network at Iowa State. You connected, got the chapter going, and then made connections with ISU Dining?
We first made connections with Food at First, which is the food pantry here in Ames.
Okay.
So the food that we recover comes from the cafes and comes every Friday. So the recoveries that we do are operated every Friday. same time, same cafe locations, but we're looking to expand to other cafe locations as well. And we do have support from Food at First, too. Mm-hmm. They have a volunteer that also picks up from the cafes on campus, too, when we can't get to them or if we don't have enough volunteers. They are working with us.
What do you actually do?
We go physically to the cafes with our bins that are empty, and we either, depending on the cafe, let the food service workers load the bins with our food, or we will load them, all the packaged food, of course. We don't handle the bakery items. We let the workers handle the bakery items, obviously, because
for food safety,
issues, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how do you transport the bins?
The bins are all transported via volunteer vehicles. So we have a driver on each side of campus. We kind of split it down the middle and go west side and east side. So all of the food is transported via volunteer cars. Then we all drive to Food at First right after all the food's picked up. And then once we're at Food at First, we will sort the food, or we'll kind of lay out the bakery items onto trays or put them in bags for
the food pantry piece.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the free market that happens on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. So we'll kind of make sure that it's ready to go for them if they need bakery items for that event as well.
When they arrive at Food at First with recovered food from these cafes as part of the ISU dining centers, one of the things they do is they weigh the food. One of the ways they help to educate people about the volume we're talking about is to get the students who engage in this kind of recovery work to figure out, well, how much food did we just move?
Right. To date now, the Iowa State Chapter Food Recovery Network has recovered 7,923 pounds of food. And in the conversion calculator that the national network has, that's the equivalent of 6,602 meals. Mm. Just since 2015 when you started this, which is so incredibly impressive. Mm-hmm. And from a national network, it's over 2 million pounds of food and almost 2 million meals. Amazing and impactful work. And I think absolutely whatever you feel like you've messed up, you have certainly taken care of it. So thank you so much.
It's a really exciting thing to be part of. A subset of students from my class become highly engaged and essentially become club members, because these are undergraduates largely in this ISU chapter of the Food Recovery Network. Most of them don't stay around in Ames during the summer. And so that initially made Food at First hesitant about how far they wanted to engage with the organization. But I think the excellent work and reliability of the ISU chapter, the Food Recovery Network, has impressed Food at First to feel like they're really
a good
part of the system,
yeah.
Even if it fades away during the summer.
And conversely, Food at First and this program really provide a national model for what can be done. And so if you're using students who are only here temporarily, they're carrying that knowledge with them. And, you know,
to where they go, absolutely.
Yeah. Educating the community, not only the Iowa State community, but also the Ames community, is one of our values in our organization. And education is such a large part because we are a flowing organization where members come and go. Having them hold that information with them and take it wherever they go is such a large part of being sustainable in general, but also having that social responsibility.
Yeah, and so in my class, I've noted is that I ask them, you know, should I keep doing this as it's now a graded requirement, an obligation. The vast majority of students to date in my class have said yes.
Yeah. What's a typical response that you've gotten when you've asked them what this adds up to for them?
When I started teaching world food issues, I myself was unaware that over a third, up to an estimated 40% of food that's produced globally is lost to waste. And when you're thinking with a sustainability mindset, that seems horrific. In industrialized countries such as the U.S., the vast amount of that is post-consumer waste, so mm-hmm. things you get on your plate or you buy at the store and then throw away. But in other countries, it may be at a much earlier stage with loss in fields or post-harvest loss. Anyway, we're talking about broader issues, and then students will reflect. And sometimes part of what they're reflecting on is who are the people who they just serve the meal to and what are their circumstances.
What inspired me to have Autumn on the show and have Laura join her is that in our last Live Green newsletter, we have a feature every month called Students Living the Cardinal Golden Green, and we chose Autumn for her work in founding the Food Recovery Network. So we did this wonderful article, and in the article, what really struck me, as well as the impact that Autumn and her fellow club members are making at Iowa State, is just the real self-commitment that Autumn has in considering food security and insecurity in the community. Autumn, I wondered if you could just talk about sort of your personal convictions and the personal commitment you make in your own life related to food waste.
I never really thought about my impacts, so what I eat, what I don't eat, what I throw away, never really resonated with me until I thought about the Food Recovery Network and started to be more sustainable and think about my actions and like what I'm actually doing versus what I could be doing and the impacts of those actions. So now I definitely think about what food I'm purchasing, whether I already have that at home or whether or not I'm eating the food that I have in my refrigerator.
And so you mentioned that when you go shopping,
yes,
you don't just make a list. You...
No, I do a fridge inventory. Uh-huh. I go through my drawers in my fridge, the vegetable crisper where I keep my cheese, my dairy little section with my yogurt and milk, my cream. I go through everything. How much do I have? Is it enough? Is that enough amount of food going to last me until my next grocery trip, or am I going to need to buy it this trip? So I kind of mental note everything and then make my list based off the things I'm actually going to need. So I don't necessarily splurge when I'm at the grocery store, and I don't always buy things based on a recipe that I want to make. I buy things that are staple things in my diet. And then I usually always create recipes based on the things I have. That can always be a really helpful way to cut back on the amount of food. It hurts our wallets when we are throwing away food, and it hurts the environment when we throw away food.
Autumn has some really good tips on saving as well. And one of the things is talking about expiration dates and how expiration dates on food may be when they might taste the freshest, but certainly they're still good after that. And all of this ugly fruit in the grocery stores actually make really delicious apple pies or applesauce or things like that. And or smoothies, I think you mentioned as well. So to not look at food at what it can't do, but what it can do, I think, is an important thing.
Yeah, and looking at the taste of the food and not necessarily how pretty it looks.
What I would just encourage folks to do, if they're interested in learning more about the network, they can read the article about Autumn in the beginning of the Food Recovery Network in our November newsletter.
Give that website.
Sure. It's livegreen.iastate.edu. Also, if folks are interested, they can just go to the Iowa State University website and type in Food Waste Recovery Network, and that will take them to the club page. And so they can get in contact with Autumn and the rest of the club members and learn more about some of the things that they are doing. And also there's a link to the national network to learn more about that as well. I would also just remind folks that we're talking about food security in the community with the holidays coming up. If you have extra things left over from your food preparation, or if you're out holiday shopping and you want to pick up an extra can of vegetables or something, taking them to Food at First, providing those additional spices or whatever you might have left over. Those are so expensive for Food at First to purchase for meal preparation. So please do that. Food at First is located in the First Christian Church right across from the Ames Police Department. And that is on 6th Avenue, correct?
Yes.
Okay. They are open most days for donations, but otherwise there are numbers right on the door you can call and make connections that way. And what I would also mention is for those things that Food at First finds that they can't really utilize, they're wonderful in supporting different food pantries throughout the community as well. So it really does get dispersed well. And even if you have empty containers from Cool Whip and cottage cheese and all those ingredients, those are wonderful takeaway containers for their patrons to take meals home with them. So all of that does a wonderful, wonderful good. So encourage people to do that. And they're always looking for volunteers as well. And if you want to come on campus and volunteer with the Food Recovery Network, I know that Autumn and her team would love to have you.
Yes, of course. We're always open to people coming and learning what we're all about and kind of why we do it and our process.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, you guys, for coming. Really enjoyed having you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we leave this special membership drive program, we need to give you a preview of next week's Pentorium sessions. Monday night is Honeywise. That's November 13th. Two lifelong musicians, Sophia Landis and Jason Surratt, come together as a dynamic mix of guitar, piano, mandolin, and Native American flutes. Honeywise plays original folk music and unique covers.
And Tuesday, November 14th, we'll have Coffee Shop Romance. Coffee Shop Romance features husband and wife duo James and Lisa Webb. James is a member of Stranger Than Fiction, the wildly popular cover band made up of local English teachers. Coffee Shop Romance is a scaled-down collaboration featuring melodic songs, guitar, and clean vocals for your cozy listening pleasure.
As always, each Pentorium session concert will take place in the KHOI lobby from 7 to 8 p.m. You can also enjoy these live performances by joining us at the station, 410 Douglas, tuning in to 89.1 FM, or streaming online at archival.khoifm.org. If you come in live, you can drop a check in to become a member at KHOI at $55, $100, or the sustaining level of $250 or more, or the bargain sustaining member of $20 a month. Just call 515-292-2878. Or text us at 515-200-7778 or pledge securely online at your website, khoifm.org.
That's just 7758, not three sevens.
Okay.
Just so everyone knows.
Okay.
It's still regular numbers.
The text number.
Rerun on the text number.
The text number, the correct text number is 515-200-7758.
Great.
Thanks, Becca.
All right. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts have been Maggie Westfold and Susan Franson. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we heard from Dennis Hart, Dennis Malsby, and Mary Rankin.
Today's show was engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Stay tuned for Democracy Now! With headlines news at the top of the hour. Morning Masterpieces will follow at 9 a.m. Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll
see you again on the radio.